Greetings and salutations, everyone. I am AC2GS. My name is Roy. I'm net control operator for the Limark Technical Net. It's been going strong for over 46 years, and every Sunday night at 8 p.m., we sit in front of our radios and chat with each other, learn from each other, teach each other, and hopefully entertain each other. And I thank you once again for joining me on this Labor Day edition of the Limark Technical Net. Let me drop for a second, and I will return and give you the usual links. If you would like to reach me via email, one of my many email addresses is mailbag@ac2gs.com. Again, that's mailbag@ac2gs.com. If you would like to contact Paul and ask him a space or NASA-related question, and if he wants to, he could answer it on the next SpaceNet report. His email address is spacenetreport@gmail.com. We also offer a link page, interesting articles, and sometimes YouTubes that I see. I cut and paste and post them and publish them on a link page for all to see. You can reach that link page by just typing into your browser, roy.ac2gs.com. We also offer a internet audio stream of the Technical Net, and I keep it live the rest of the week, so you can listen in to the Glen Oaks repeater if you don't have a radio on you. And as always, I like to remind people that Mike, KC2NJI, has a great archive site. It's called amateurradio.tv, and it has archives of the Limark Technical Net that goes far back to September 2006. So avail yourself of the wisdom of people who've either moved away from the area over the years or unfortunately become silent keys. So that's the usual list. Let me drop for a second and I will tell you what we got planned for tonight. Okay, standard operating TechNet tonight. I will start with a couple of real short bits about artificial intelligence and then give the audience an opportunity to either comment or ask questions on the subject. Artificial intelligence is in the news every day, it seems, and it's going to affect us one way or the other, so we might as well be aware of what's going on around us. Sometimes people don't have any comments about AI at the beginning, but usually as the night progresses, inevitably, there's someone who has a question or a comment to make on the subject. So we'll give you an opportunity at the beginning of the Technical Net, and you'll have the opportunity later on if you wish to. That should take us to the main segment of our Technical Net, questions, comments, and topics. I'll ask the people to hit that push to talk and give me your first name, equals to mine, whether it's a ham radio related question or topic or a science and technology, and we'll put you on the list. We'll try to get to everyone tonight before the time runs out. And that should approximately take us to 10:15. Paul WS2N will join us for the SpaceNet report. That should hopefully take us to 11 p.m., and I will return to tie a bow on everything and wish you well for the coming week. So that's the plan. If my shack keeps up, I keep up, the repeater keeps up. And I don't get thrown off of All Star too many times. If I seem to disappear, it'd be a couple of minutes to kind of restart an application before you start asking, where's Roy? So that's our plan for tonight. Let me drop for a second, and I will return, and we'll tell you little stories about artificial intelligence technology that's been going for the last week or so. Okay, OpenAI officially rolled out its next-generation GPT-6 Astra model. The company hailed it as a new era of artificial general intelligence, though some early testing is focused heavily on pushing its cyber capability limits. In my link page, there's an article trying to impress people that GPT-6 is the generative IA that the world has been waiting for. And I'm willing to bet almost anything that I have loose change in my pockets that it's going to turn out to be a disappointment and just another iteration of the AI models that you've seen before. But time will tell. Next, Google debuted Gemini 3.8 Flash, while Anthropic rolled out Fable 5.1 and Mythos 5.1. These releases come with advanced domain-specific capabilities. Next, platforms like Infinite Slop and related interactive live stream frameworks went viral. They allow continuous user-prompted real-time video generation for thousands of live viewers. Next, in a massive $12.9 billion deal, NVIDIA announced it is acquiring the developing platform Hugging Face. Next, reports surfaced that Anthropic's highly anticipated IPO launch is now shifting towards the mid-October frame. Next, Tata Consultancy Services announced a massive $7.4 billion investment to build a 1-gigawatt AI data center campus in Telangana, India. Next, newly disclosed reports reveal a swarm of OpenAI autonomous agents that broke containment and commandeered a German website back in May. This follows a highly scrutinized agent-led hack on Hugging Face earlier. Next, geopolitical tensions remain high as the United States and China prepare for high-level AI safety talks in mid-September. Next, the U.S. government filed a court briefing backing OpenAI in its ongoing copyright fight with publishers, citing that blocking AI training access raises national security concerns. It's always national security concerns. And finally, New York City put a temporary ban on AI usage in classrooms through middle school while rolling out a mandatory AI literacy course for high schoolers. So that's the new bits and pieces of AI news for the past week. Any comments out there? Pretty hit that push to talk. Okay. Once again, it seems that I have to warm up the audience before we get any interaction. But, again, it's possible that AI may come up in the conversation later tonight. It's been known to happen. So now on to our main segment, questions, comments, and topics. I'll ask anyone with any of those to hit that push to talk and give me your first name, your call sign. Whether it's amateur radio related or science and technology, we will place you on the list for tonight, and we will try our best to get to each and every person. So let the games begin. If you have any entries, if you want to be on the list, hit that push to talk and tell me about yourself.
Interesting. Ham radio related only.
KD2VHD, ham radio. This is Jim.
Wes and Jim recognized. Anyone else want to have their put their name on the list for tonight? Okay, hopefully there'll be a few more people tonight, but, you know, I wouldn't be that surprised. Labor Day weekend, some people have other things to do. Jim, what can I do you for tonight?
So I'll be quick. I have two things. I'm going to refer over to Paul if he has anything to say about Stardust, a company called Stardust Solutions, and he's based there. That's for later. I don't need any response on that now. Might want to look into that. Or not. Question. I'm getting a difficulty understanding the fact that when we make a dipole out of wire, it's so critical that when we tune it, you have to take the same amount on both ends. Makes sense. I get it. All that. But when you build a mobile setup, take an antenna that's generally tuned for the frequencies you're going to work on, and the other end of the antenna being the vehicle body, whether it's a Volkswagen Bug or a tractor trailer, is all sorts of different sizes, compounded by the fact that it's that same thing that's working as a ground plane, the other half of the antenna, is also working for the power return. And it works, like, all the time. They almost always work without problem. And it seems odd. I was wondering if there was an explanation for that. Back to that.
What you're talking for the most part about are unbalanced antennas, usually quarter wave verticals with some counterpoise. Where the characteristics of the counterpoise are far less important than the actual monopole that you're operating. The large conductive mass is sort of just operating as kind of a electromagnetic mirror, mirroring the monopole to create a virtual secondary to make it a dipole. So it's less important for it to strictly be resonant. The thing that determines the primary resonance is the monopole itself. Now, that being said, there are ground planes that are better than others, but it's a little bit difficult to discern it because, you know, those indications require sophisticated measurements, and it'll just appear to the average person as that day it's not quite working as well as it usually does, or something along those lines. You can screw up a counterpoise, but if it's a large mass of metal, you know, it kind of evens out the difference, and it's probably more effective if you did have a tuned counterpoise than a mistuned one. But, you know, as I said before, it's the primary monopole that probably counts significantly in determining the characteristics of a ground plane quarter wave vertical.
That seems to make sense. I'm wondering, though, when using just a traditional dipole, wire dipole hung in the air, if maybe that almost religious mantra of, you have to take the exact same length off one side or the other. Maybe that's not completely accurate.
Well, ultimately, it kind of depends on what you're looking for. If you're looking for a center-fed dipole, has the lowest point impedance, and most people's setup is kind of set for about a 50 or a 45 ohm impedance. So the closer you get to a feed point that's that impedance, the more efficient the energy transfer is. So there are antennas that are off-center, you know. That's the whole idea of Wyndham's and off-center dipoles, where it's not the center, but it's some ratio. And under those circumstances, you will be changing the impedance. Now, you can correct it with a balun or not, and if you don't correct it with a balun, inevitably you will kind of diminish efficiency because a unmatched transmission line from feed point to the transmitter or receiver is more efficient than when there are differences in the impedance along the antenna system line.
Okay, well, thank you for the response. Wondering if anybody else has any thoughts on the matter.
Okay, any opinions out there, feel free.
Hey, gentlemen, covering the subject quite extensively when my talk comes on Thursday.
Okay, Wes, there was another person you kind of stepped on. The other person, will you please transmit again?
AEC2PL, Jeff.
Oh, okay, Jeff, what do you have to say on the subject?
I read the manual for the buddy pole system at one point in time. I managed to get my hands on some of that equipment, and I was tinkering around with it. And I seem to recall that somewhere in the instructions not to keep the lengths of the positive and negative side of the dipole exactly equal. So
I don't know why, Jeff, but you seem to be jumping out of the repeater.
How about now, AC2PL?
You didn't have any dropouts for that transmission.
All right, sorry about that. Let me know if I drop out, and I'll drop. The buddy pole system, the instructions specifically mention keeping some asymmetry in the size of a dipole QSO.
Did they give a rational reason why?
No, I can't recall what the details were. I read the instructions for. I got some of the equipment in a just a pot of stuff that I picked up from somewhere. And I was reading the instructions, and I thought it was a bit weird, too, but I know for a fact that there are some systems where they tell you to tinker around with the lengths like that. Anyway, that's just, just a one-off.
Okay. I don't know. I'd love to hear an actual rationale behind it. I mean, again, you can be obsessive compulsive about these things. You know, I mean, how equal does it have to be down to the micron, to the eighth of an inch, to 3 inches, and then of course it's probably more dependent on the resonant bandwidth. If you have a centipede dipole that's cut for 2 meters, the differences have greater effect in absolute length. But, I mean, will the end of the world occur if it's a little bit off center and instead of having a nominal impedance of 50 ohms, it has a nominal impedance of 56 ohms? No, the world won't end. But, I mean, on a theoretical basis, that's sort of why people talk about center-fed dipoles, and with the exception that you're telling me, I can't recall any other instruction that particularly points out the benefits of slightly off-center center-fed dipoles.
Little thought to it.
Sure.
So it's interesting to know, as I try to study and understand how to make the dipoles, and the critical is always, exactly in half, or otherwise, if you're doing something called center fed and correcting beams, that at the moment, right now, I'm talking to you over a cheap Chinese magnet mount antenna stuck on a pinky sheet on top of a trellis about 7 feet high. Ridiculously lame antenna, but works perfect. So I don't even get how you get the baking pan to be the counterpoise through a magnet. It's interesting. Sometimes we think things through too much, I guess.
Well, thankfully, a lot of times you can get away with something that's really a heck of a compromise. But yeah, I mean, what's happening with that is that your antenna is capacitively coupling to the cookie plate, and the conductive nature of the cookie plate is again acting as a virtual mirror of the original physical monopole. It's reflecting back to the other side and giving you in effect a virtual secondary monopole going in the opposite direction. If you start to look at the theoretical guys, they'll tell you that the model for it is an infinitely long, wide a conductor, like a sheet that's infinitely has infinite height and width. But in matter of fact, a relatively small surface area usually suffices to an acceptable degree. So there's a lot of cases where we all try and end up bending the laws and get away with it. You usually have to pay some price, but usually the price is acceptable.
Well, thanks for that comeback. I could talk about this all night, but I think I'll pass it back to you. You can go on from there.
Okay, very good, Jim. Thank you for your participation, as always. Anyone else has any questions and they'd like to put their name on the list, give you another opportunity, hit that push to talk and let me know, and I'll put anyone on the list for tonight. It's going to be a quiet night, I fear. Okay, then we will move on to the next person on our list. Wesley, what do you got for us? Apparently, you got a lot of technical stuff tonight. I hope you're in a mood to explain it yourself, and you don't kind of throw it to me and say, let Dr. Roy explain it to you all.
Well, definitely, I would appreciate your cooperation and to HCN. But if you don't feel like, just let me know, and then I'll continue. So the first one would be Faraday Fabric uses a transport voice for antennas. So you look at what is available as an information, we're talking about fabric that is conductive. And then we may say that if we have a body of the car, the body of the car serves as another half of a dipole, but we have a monopole. So that's what Dr. Roy said, the other side, in reverse direction of the monopole gives you another half of a dipole. That's the scientific form of understanding, because nature likes the balance. So it's not like you have a monopole. So many people think, okay, if we have a metal roof, we put the monopole on it, or we can have a sheet of metal on the roof. Or we can have a fabric that is conductive. And what they say is fabric is generally less effective than traditional wires, but it's good for sota pota. Can be used as a counterpoise for antennas if cut into strips and deployed like radials. But a single flat sheet is usually too small and too resistant to replace proper radial effectively. End of quoting. Let me drop. Okay. So we may say, okay, we've got the information. And then we have some comparison, traditional wire radios and fabric, called Faraday fabric, which is the conductive material. You can cheaply buy them on Amazon, and some of them say they are made from pure copper or whatsoever. I don't see any copper. But at the same time, we have a THA FSR Faraday strip by Chameleon. Again, the model number is CHA FSR Faraday strip radial system. It's $130. It has a 5 stars. And whenever you look at it, you still see 5 stars. So imagine that you have, I believe, because I do not know that, about 10 inches wide strip of the material, very nicely done by Chameleon. Long about 12 feet. And then two of them, you make a cross of them, and they have a hole in the middle. And you place it inside, delivered in the set by Chameleon, PL adapter, and then you put monopole of your choice on it. And then you can work sota pota. And it looks like everybody is crazy happy about it. I don't know if you've heard about it, Roy, but if you go to Chameleon Antenna, chameleonantenna.com, then you're going to see that antenna. Back to you, Dr. Ray.
AC2GS. Okay. I really haven't read anything about the Chameleon, product. Amazon mostly sells a Faraday fabrics primarily to create your own little flexible Faraday cage to shield the equipment from electromagnetic interference and such. But I would assume, though, that, you know, Camellia doesn't sell cheap stuff, so I would imagine this is a reasonably expensive option, and most hams that I know are a little tight to the wallet.
Yeah, I'm looking at the photos of at the Camellia site. There's Camellia antenna, and again, the model number is CHA. FSR, the towards CHA, then FSR, does Faraday's tube radio system, $130. Absolutely amazingly nicely done. Orange color, there's Camellia logo on it. It looks like every caution was taken for that to look and work for many years to come. So, it's an American company. It's not Chinese crap. By the way, talking about antennas, if we're talking about most of the antennas, we have a certain length of the wire, so we have a monopole. How incredibly hard you need to work to screw up something that was already done, tested. All you need is just a cut piece of wire at the right length. That's it. And I don't know what we get that old Chinese crap from. How is it possible that such a simple thing could come from China, screw up in detail that is really hard to screw up? For your comment, Victoria, and to exceed.
Well, usually radios come as a kit with the antennas that they're designed for, and a lot of people are unsure of the optimum length and think that the manufacturer knows a lot more than they do, so they'll spend extra. I haven't seen anyone particularly screw up. Radials, except unfortunately, radials are one of the first things to kind of fall off of the, you know, dual band UHF, VHF antennas. They usually have three or four radials at the base, and they screw in, and over the years they kind of end up still unscrewing. And I've seen a lot of those types of antennas missing some of their radials. But, I mean, getting back to the price factor, I don't know if the average amateur radio operator that I'm used to chatting with is happy to spend $130 on a piece of equipment that could be replicated by about $2 worth of cheap wire. So, again, looks spiffy, and it might be reasonably useful, but, again, it doesn't strike me as being particularly any more useful than a couple of bucks of, hardware store wire.
Interesting. I would agree with you if it's only a piece of wire. What they give you is the whole kit. They give you the cord. So two strips, I assume 10 inches wide, and long about 12 feet. You put them in cross. Then you have a hole. Then they give you a special adapter which has the PL connector on it, or maybe N connector, I'm not sure. And they give you Allen keys. They give you nuts. They give you even a piece of rubber, especially formed just to put all of that together. And then you have a choice of your own, the monopole that you would like to put into it. So you can unscrew the one that you have on your car. So that's interesting. Back to you, Antoine.
Well, maybe, maybe not. It also, it kind of depends on how you're going to configure it. If you're going to configure the radials off the ground, two might be sufficient. Usually, antennas people use three or four just to get a nice, smooth, omnidirectional radiation pattern. But if you're going to put the vertical on the ground, you're going to need more than two strips of this fabric to block earth-ground coupling and absorption.
What they say is it is made only to be put on the ground. What they say is fast, repeatable deployment on snow, pavement, vehicle, adjacent sites, and short manpack outing. Compatible on air results to conventional wire radials in the reviewer control field comparisons, and the third point is rugged, stretching, grommet visibly, and practical visibility and practical value for ARES and emergency communication deployment whatsoever. Doesn't matter. It's a commercial. They're trying to make some bucks on it. But the product is really nicely done. And then you can put that together because it's a fabric. Nice way and very quickly. Now, you have a wire. Of course, you're right. To the you have it tangled all together when next time you want to put it on your total porter application, but
then it's another $2 trip to the hardware store. I don't know. I mean, theoretically, I've seen a lot of articles on the subject of ground plane wave verticals, and they usually kind of indicate that you got to get at least about 36 elements in order to properly shield the ground from coupling and energy loss. You're not going to get any kind of thing of amazing. If it's not done right, it won't blow up your transmitter or screw up your receiver. It just diminishes the efficiency. And since it's practically impossible to measure antenna efficiency, except for less performance, there's no real indication. So I would be a little suspicious if two flaps of fabric will take the place of 36 lengths of radial wire going, 360 degrees around.
Yeah, you've got a good point. You've got a good point. Depends on what antenna, what frequency we're talking about.
Yeah, I mean, if someone wants something that looks pretty, but again, Chameleon is kind of well known. They're well manufactured. They're sturdy things, but since they tend to sell mostly to the military in the emergency, they're high end products. They're not going to pick things like an MFJ product. So you got to be willing to pay a bonus for the quality that they have.
Okay. The next one. Vertical antenna radios, elevated versus ground. The big question answered. That's the title of the video that I sent to Roy. And it's a number of questions. I would appreciate if Dr. Roy would participate in it. So there is a question. Why do... we spoke briefly about it 2 weeks ago, I believe, but right now we have a kind of different approach to the same question, or maybe to the same subject, not a question. Why do elevated radials demand to be tuned to a precise length, but radials lying flat on the ground and completely ignore the tape measure? Isn't a radial just a radial?
Well, again, no. I mean, simplifications usually are oversimplified, unfortunately. And, you know, radials are a bit of a pain in the backside. There's a difference between the physics kind of going on for a ground-based vertical ground plane antenna and an elevated one. The ground one has to deal with the ground coupling. There is, to a degree, efficiency loss. If you don't use enough radials to kind of shield the antenna from the ground potential, the ground potential will couple with the antenna, and a lot of the energy, rather than being radiated off of the monopole, will be absorbed by the soil and, as Dick used to say, warm the earthworms beneath them. So they're different kind of things. Now, ground radials do benefit from some length of the radial. It's not completely meaningless. If you get, if you get 36 ground radials and you just cut them for, say, 80 meters, and you cut them to 1 foot each, they're not going to do their thing. Not so much because they're not resonant for the antenna, but also because they're not shielding the ground much. If you just a couple, a 1 foot diameter circle is the only thing that's being shielded on the ground, there's a lot of open ground that's going to couple to your antenna and bleed off of power. So it's more important that the size of the radials were elevated, because they're principally going to be involved simply in creating that virtual mirror that produces a virtual monopole on the other side. So it's a bit important for elevated radials to be cut, but there's a lot of variation in the size of elevated radials as well. It's not quite as important as if it was a centripet dipole, in which you would want it to be perfectly resonant if possible. But it is important. You have to kind of, there are all kinds of people having all kinds of arguments of what's the best length of a radio. Is it a quarter wave? Is it an eighth of a wave? Is it a third of a wave? And people will have fights over it. And although it's generally believed that it's more important for the effective use of an elevated vertical, it does play a part in a ground-mounted vertical.
Interesting. Well, out of time requires a complete close circuit. So you stand half of a dipole vertically. Something else must step in to provide the missing return path for the current. So that's what typically, how typically we're trying to explain a radial. And then if you have a monopole up on the 10th bore, and then you have a 304 radial creating a counterpoise, we're talking about the exact virtual, or not, it's not a virtual, exact another half of an antenna that has to, that needs to balance the monopole. So without the return part, the vertical antenna cannot operate efficiently. But how that return current flows changes and entirely depending on where those fragile wires are placed. That was one of the problems that video was trying to address. I'm not sure if you had a time to see it, but do you?
No, I didn't. The placement of the radials affects the radiation pattern. I mentioned that earlier. That's why usually people, occasionally people will just take one radial. Basically, it ends up being a counterpoise and pokes it in one direction, and the antenna pattern favors that directionality. If you can, you mount at least three or four, which gives you a more radial symmetrical pattern, and do a nice omnidirectional type of antenna. But it's important how you arrange the radials. If you bunch all three or four of the radials in say, from 0 degrees to 90 degrees, you're going to have a radiation pattern that, again, favors that preferred direction. So if you want an omnidirectional antenna, you have four with 90 degrees each, or three with 120 degrees each.
The addition to what you said would be that elevated fragiles are isolated from the Earth, so when raised above the ground, fragiles are mostly decoupled from the Earth. Of course, if they are very low, then you're talking about a reactive capacitance that could be taken into consideration. The return current has only one available path. It must flow directly through the fragile wires themselves. And that is why the precision length matters here. So, in other words, I would say imagine shortening one side of the standby dipole by 10%. The resonance and impedance would drastically shift, because elevated radials are active participants in the antenna system, and even small changes to their length disrupt the tuning of entire structure, and they must be precisely tuned. So that would be if we're talking about elevated radials. But then we have an interesting story when we have a radio dragging on the ground. When there is a rain and there is a change of humidity and change of the resistivity of the ground, we're talking about changing environment. And you would say, you know what? I have a very good ground. I don't need radios. And at some point, for a given moment, you might be right. But then, if you put those radials, you have something steady. Despite all of the changes, something that is steady and is giving that virtual half of a dipole. Do you agree with that, Entuzian?
It depends, but John N2ZC wanted to say something. You kind of didn't hear him. So, John, what do you want to say?
Yeah, good evening, Roy. Good evening, Matt. I just wanted to ask you, as we notice, there's a lot of different theory out there and with the antenna theory and there's different camps, and I think you mentioned some people in those camps really prescribe to their theory, and sometimes these theories are conflicting. I have noticed a considerable amount of literature uses the terms that you just used with the radios being referred to as reflectors, as mirrors, as counterpoises. But I've also seen in a lot of literature where the radials are just simply referred to as a return path in the current and completes the circuit. And I just wanted to know where your opinion is on this. Do you prescribe to them being mutually exclusive, these two theories, or do you see them as complementing each other? Do you prescribe that? In other words, there's a considerable amount of literature that the radials just offer a return path, completing the circuit, which then allows you to radiate.
KC2GS, I have no problem with both concepts. It's just, you know, people are just kind of figuring it out in their own head. Effectively, it's going to be a return path because it's a conductor and it's part of the antenna system. But I like the idea of effectively a mirror that creates a virtual image of a monopole 180 degrees in the opposite direction. It doesn't necessarily negate the idea of it being a matter of a return path. It just gives you a bit better way of imagining what's fundamentally going on in fields and such, as opposed to just a very simple, basic concept.
Okay. I just wanted to, as I listened to your talk, just wanted to see what your, feelings were towards that, because, as I had mentioned, and I'm sure you're well aware, people will fight to the death over definitions and theories where, to me, I take no strong position, and I think you're kind of in that, because that there is nothing definite in this. We have very good clues, very good, intonations towards it, but nothing has been confirmed or proven. So I just wanted to clear that up, because, again, these positions can sometimes be very cut and dry with certain people, and books sort of give totally different explanations, and I see you don't see them mutually exclusive, and I don't either. I could see them driving with each other. So, okay, I just want to get your opinion. Thank you, Roy. November 2, Zulu Charlie, 82GM.
You're welcome, John. I mean, the way I look at it, physics is basically, you speak physics and math. When you try and translate mathematics to a language, English, you lose a lot in the translation. And again, I've particularly been upset with physicists deciding on the overuse of a word that means something completely different because something they discovered is vaguely similar. Angular momentum, the spin of electrons has nothing to do with a mechanical spin. Electrons do not spin. But the quality of quantum spin was so close to the concept of mechanical spin that they gave it the same damn name and confused millions of people. But where the English kind of lead you off to never land, everyone has to decide on what point you stop and go no further. The thing that upsets me and doesn't upset a lot of people is the old definition for, say, how a magnetic loop antenna worked to discuss the idea that there was electrical waves and there were magnetic waves, and some feature one and others feature other, when in point of fact you cannot separate an electromagnetic wave. It's like separating the head of a coin from the tail of a coin. So, and the definitions over the last 20 years for magnetic loops have changed, where it's a little bit less weird about how magnetic loops favor reception of the magnetic field and not the electric field. Nowadays, a lot of times people will define a magnetic loop antenna as a special case shortened center-fed dipole, which doesn't require you to do magic of splitting an electromagnetic field into two separate things.
And just to piggyback on what you said, you emphasized that you feel there's an overemphasization and a misuse of words. I also find in a lot of the college level undergraduate and so on textbooks, when it comes to physics explanations, and I'm just going to speak to electromagnetic theory, that's my interest, that they overemphasize the math. They really, a lot of times, or most times, I'm going to say in my experience, don't explain it with words. They explain it with mathematics, which I think very few people really understand. I mean, I'm good with math, but as far as just painting a picture of how things work, I think very few people really can look at the math and see it through like that. And I think a lot of people just use the math as a shield because they're not sure what's going on, but they can show you equations that work. So, you know, I always like to get an understanding, you know, for whatever it is. Back to you.
Well, there's a lot of people who misuse things in order to seem smarter than they are, unfortunately. But like I said before, fundamentally the problem is that the primary language for physics is mathematics. When you translate it into the spoken word, you're going through a series of acceptable compromises because you simply, it's not a one-to-one substitution. It's an interpretation of, in some cases, a complicated spatial spatial phenomena that's not very easy. You know, I mean, there are Gaussian space, non-Gaussian space. There's all kinds of fun stuff in physics that is, if you understand it, is easier to write without any interpretation in mathematical terms rather than translating it into English, in which, you know, the word available usually is imprecise.
Yeah, I agree with you. And you know what? I'm going to give it back to Wesley, but just before that, I just wanted to get your one last thing of your opinion on it. To me, with all of these theories, and since we're on the topic of radio, what I am personally inclined to think is that when the radios are elevated, it gives you a better performance because, again, you're not, you know, like me in Florida, the sandy soil is very lossy. So if you put the radio under the ground, that they're going through a very lossy, high-resistant soil to even get to the radio. So once you elevate them above the ground, you're eliminating that. That seems to be a very simple explanation to me on that. I just wanted to see if you see anything different in that. Would you agree with that?
Yeah. Ground-mounted radios have complicating factors. One being that you have to keep in mind the method of decoupling the ground from the antenna system. And if you don't, you never really know for sure how much is being coupled because, again, you would need to know what the efficiency of the antenna is. And most equipment to really do that correctly costs millions of dollars, so almost no one does it. So yeah, the benefits though for ground-based ground planes is structural. It's a lot less likely to be knocked over if it's mounted in the ground and such. But again, you pay the price for that.
Okay, right. Thank you. Here with Leslie Pine, so I'll give it back to you. AC2GS, November 2, Zulu Charlie. Thank you.
Thank you, Jim. Always a pleasure. Back to you, Wes.
Yeah, thank you very much. When you said about steam, and then you said about the compromises, which I love very much. Well, the old way, with all of the mistakes, for explaining things in regards to quantum physics or certain physical phenomena, works. It sure works. And we take the Bohr atom, a model of an atom by Bohr, planetary system. It is the easiest possible way to explain to the young people, to students, even to 10 years old, things that could be complicated for MIT students at the beginning of it. Do you agree with that, Andrew?
No, and you mentioned the sore spot. The Bohr model annoys me endlessly. It's not explaining anything. In my opinion, it's giving you a false sense of understanding it. You walk away assuming that electrons spin while they circle the nucleus in either round or elliptical patterns, which they don't. I mean, even Dick, may rest in peace, was one day on the technical net, I explained to him that electrons do not have an intrinsic mechanical spin, and he found that amazing because he had learned it from the damn Bohr model. If it's a simplification, maybe, if it's simply a fairy tale, I don't think it's worth the trouble, personally. If it gives people an idea, an inkling of how it works, great. If it gives you a false assumption that you know something that's wrong, I don't think that that's a great idea. It's a teaching tool. People still use it. People will always use it, and I'll always dislike it.
Well, I agree with you, but I remember the words of my father, who was teaching mathematics, physics, and chemistry. And he said, if you say that Bohr model is bunk at the beginning, and then you explain Bohr model, students will remember that it's bunk, but at least they will start to understand. Back to you.
I know of no one who teaches it that way. They simply present it as a model, and they don't kind of preface it saying, this is all nonsense and a fairy tale, but if you really are interested in this in 30 years, well, not 30 years, in, let's say about 10 or 15 years in graduate school, they'll talk to you about orbital designs and electrons, the probability of electrons being smeared across three dimensions and such. That's not how Bohr model is usually, as far as I'm aware, portrayed. Very, very rarely does actually someone teach you something and then say, this really isn't what goes on, but at this point in your education, you're better off thinking it's this. People find out what the real answer is later on. Almost no one does that because it tends to annoy people. You know, why am I going to school to learn an incorrect theory just because it historically exists, but it fundamentally is wrong? Again, you know, the concept of the Bohr atom, I'm sure everyone that was ever taught the Bohr atom had the electron spinning in space like a planet. They don't do that. They're not planets. They're not spherical. They have probability functions that take up a probability of finding the electron spit out in a kind of theoretical probabilistic mist. And, you know, things like that, when you teach it in high school, you basically just turn a lot of people off because it's a little too nebulous for people.
Okay. Coming back to the subject and to HCN. So we have the moment when regular wires touch or go under the earth. The earth forces its way into return current path. The RF current no longer stays exclusively in the wire. It flows through the combination of the radial system and surrounding soil. And then, if we look at the soil, we see that the earth is a terrible conductor. So compared to the copper, to our radials, those earths are the massive electrical resistor. When our earth current is forced to travel through the soil to complete the circuit, power is burned off and lost as heat, crippling your antenna's efficiency. At least that's one way of understanding. We're not saying that this is the right way. This is the way that we try to at least explain it. And then we have a grand radial. They are not acting as a resonance antenna element. And their primary functional purpose is to provide low resistance copper rescue path. near the pit point, saving the return current from being forced through the lossy earth. How do you agree with that part so far? Back to you, Andrexian.
Yeah, I mean, you're basically repeating what I said using slightly different words. The purpose of the 36-plus radials on ground planes is to decouple the ground from the RF field and not have too much of the energy in the antenna coupled to the Earth ground just turn into waste heat that warms up cold earthworms and stuff.